Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine, and we're going to continue reading from the April 8th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And we're going to start this week with Ramadan in Gaza by Abir Ramakat. Ramadan has a very special place in every Muslim's heart. We wait for it all year. As a small child, I remember my excitement at hanging colorful lanterns on my house. My parents taught my siblings and me to abstain from food and drink from dawn to dusk. But the holy month of Ramadan started early for Muslims in Gaza this year. In some sense, we've been fasting since October. The idea of fasting is to train yourself to be patient, to elevate your soul from mundane desires, to try to free your mind from evil impulses and do good deeds for people around you. Nothing could have been preparing me for Ramadan this year. I wasn't sure I was even going to survive until Ramadan. At least 30,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed since the Hamas attack on October 7th, and that's according to the health ministry in the Strip. And 80% of the population has been displaced amid Israel's ongoing bombardment. For those of us lucky enough to be alive, fleeing from place to place, we have undergone a partial fast for months, not wanting to eat the scant food of the families kind enough to shelter us, unable to find food to purchase in the markets or even to afford what can be found. Since the war began, my life has been turned upside down. My home in Gaza City, where my children and I used to hang Ramadan lights, is now destroyed and my family is scattered. I woke on March 11th, the first day of fasting, an hour before dawn, to prepare the pre-fast meal known as the Suhar. This is usually a moment of profound joy and spirituality, but this year I could not hold back my tears. The mosques lie in ruins, so neighbors all around performed this call to prayer on their own initiative. This suhar consisted of stone-hard bread, which I baked from barley, corn, soy, and even bird feed that we managed to find and ground together. The sand-like taste was tempered by the fact that we were able to dip it in olive oil that we had pressed from our own olive trees before the war, which I found in my father's deserted home in Gaza City. It pained me not to be able to offer food from a plentiful table to our neighbors, as is customary and instructed by the Prophet Muhammad. For our first meal after fasting, I had saved two small bags of pasta. Though it was infested with weevils, I managed to clean and boil the pasta and serve it with tomato sauce for iftar. I used to partially prepare the next day's iftar the night before so that my fasting hours could be focused on worship. With so much scarcity, this is now a faraway dream. In years past, we would pray in the mosque after iftar and then visit our close relatives, sharing the kadayef, a Ramadan dessert drenched in syrup. These visits would present an opportunity to forgive those who may have wronged us, strengthening our social fabric. With so many mosques destroyed and no kadayef amid a dearth of food, I cannot celebrate with my parents, siblings, and their spouses and children. There are 20 of them all crammed into a one-bedroom apartment in central Gaza. Instead, my family spent the early part of Ramadan with friends, 16 of us in a small apartment to the north in Gaza City. But we awoke one suhoor to the sound of tank fire and heavy shelling, learning that Israeli soldiers had stormed the nearby Al-Shifra hospital. So we fled for the 11th time since the war began, all of us keenly feeling the absence of friends and family seeking refuge scattered around Gaza. We all have extended family members killed by Israeli strikes, tanks, or snipers. Yesterday, my 18-year-old daughter Rana had a crying fit. When she finally calmed down, she asked, "Mom, for how long do we have to live in this nightmare? I want to go home. I want to sleep in my bed and have my things around me." Rana has been strong throughout, telling jokes to lift our spirits and keep us calm throughout the bombardments. But starting a Ramadan filled with violence and sorrow, she said, had pushed her over the edge. It would be easy to lose faith when inhumanity surrounds us every day in Gaza. It may sound strange, but after surviving almost 6 months of brutal war, the start of the holy month has in some ways deepened my faith. I wish this year that fasting were only about purifying our souls from the body's mundane desires. But for us Gazans, it has also meant learning to live without many people that we love. I hope they are in a better place now. For those of us who live on, we also think of our homes and communities built with love and care that no longer exist. Even if after Ramadan the war finally does come to an end, as we are all fervently praying for, everyone in Gaza knows nothing will ever be as it was again. Now let's head over to the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Bolsonaro and Trump apart, yet together again. A president facing a tough fight for re-election warns his followers that corrupt elites want to steal power from them. He loses the election and calls on his supporters to defend him. Unable to block the transfer of power, he retreats to Florida. His supporters attack government buildings to protest the election result. Out of power, the former leader now faces criminal charges and accusations that he's the one who's tried to steal the last election. He remains a formidable political force, one who will shape his country's politics for years to come. This is the story of Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro. There's one crucial difference between Bolsonaro's current position and that of former President Donald Trump. Courts in Brazil have ruled that his accusations that the country's voting machines were used to rig the election against him disqualify Bolsonaro from running for office for 8 years, while Trump is the presumptive GOP nominee. On March 1st, a former army commander reportedly told federal police that Bolsonaro was considering issuing a presidential decree to revoke the results of the election that he had just lost. That account aligns with claims made by other officials. Bolsonaro denies these charges. His approval rating stands at 43%, up 10 points since he left office, and 38% of respondents told the pollsters that the election was stolen from him. On February 25th, Bolsonaro held a peaceful rally in Sao Paulo, attended by an estimated 600,000 to 750,000 people. Major opposition leaders support Bolsonaro's message that he's a victim of persecution. Unlike Trump, Bolsonaro has avoided criticizing the courts and the judges. Bolsonaro cannot seek office again until at least 2030. But even if he ends up behind bars for some time, he will be the principal kingmaker for the opposition to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's government for the foreseeable future. His supporters, like those attached to Trump and other charismatic populists, won't easily be moved by further accusations against their hero. In years ahead, more populists will fuel election campaigns not on resentment of elite politicians, but on charges of conspiracy against those who would fight for the common people and a deep distrust of political institutions. The number of people who get their news from sources that algorithmically feed their biases will continue to grow. Authoritarian governments like those in China, Russia, and Iran will use digital weapons to exploit the divisions in Western democracies. But the next major test of this strategy of populist defiance will come on November 5th, when more than 150 Americans will cast votes on a rematch between President Joe Biden and the man who says Biden stole the last election from him and the American people. Next, we have the brief, the bulletin. Why India's next election will last 44 days. India's elections are the largest democratic exercise in the world, with nearly 970 million registered voters expected to cast ballots, including 18 million new voters. The Election Commission of India, the ECI, has announced that this year's poll will take place in seven phases, lasting 44 days. Indians will head to the polls from April 19th to June 1st. The results are to be declared on June 4th. First, we have historic timeline. The election will be the second longest polling exercise in India's electoral history. Balloting is broken down not only by phase but also by region, all in the hope of administering an orderly election. In some states like Bihar, West Bengal, and Uttar Pradesh, voting will take place on all 7 days the ECI has announced, April 19th, April 26th, May 7th, May 13th, May 20th, May 25th, and June 1st. In others like Pradesh and Sikkim, balloting will take place only on one day. The scattered approach is number two. The regional phases of India's elections are determined based on how populated as well as how contentious the vote might be in each state. For example, voting in the most densely populated state of Uttar Pradesh, which is also notorious for political intimidation and electoral influence, is broken up into seven phases. Only in the end, after all ballots have been cast nationwide, are votes counted. The tally and the announcement of the results happen on the same day. No one, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, knows who won any given seat beforehand. And lastly, free and fair. The election is coming at a time when India is grappling with the challenge of ensuring voter participation, free speech, and electoral independence while authoritarianism is on the rise. During Modi's second term, Freedom House downgraded India's democracy rating from free to partly free because of the government's discriminatory policies against Muslims, as well as its targeting of critics and the media. Next we have from the brief, we have good question. Are pigs the future of organ transplants? And is by Alice Park. On March 16th, a transplant surgery team at Massachusetts General Hospital successfully transplanted a modified pig kidney into a human, 62-year-old Richard Slayman. The groundbreaking four-hour surgery was the culmination of years of work transplanting kidneys from a specially bred group of pigs, genetically modified to more closely resemble those of humans, into primates. Encouraged by the results, the team at Mass General Brigham was confident that it was time to test the pig organs in the first patient. Slayman, a manager at the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, had received a human kidney transplant 5 years ago. But as often is the case with kidney disease, the organ began to fail, and he continued to need dialysis. His health progressively worsened. At one point, he literally said, "I just cannot go on like this," says Dr. Winfred Williams, Slayman's physician and associate chair of nephrology at Massachusetts General, during a briefing. Dr. Tatsuo Kawai, director of the hospital's Legareta Center for Clinical Transplant Tolerance, who had performed the human transplant 5 years ago, also performed the pig kidney surgery. As more than a dozen people watched, Kawai carefully connected the pig kidney to Slayman's circulatory system, not an easy task given the patient's history of diabetes and hypertension, which had weakened his blood vessels. "The size of the pig kidney was exactly the same as the human kidney," he says. Upon restoration of blood flow into the kidney pinked up immediately and started to make urine. "When we saw the first urine output, everyone in the operating room burst into applause. It was truly the most beautiful kidney I have ever seen." The kidney came from a special group of pigs bred to produce human-like kidneys. Biotech company eGenesis worked closely with the hospital to produce them using genetic innovations developed over recent decades. The pigs' cells were treated with the gene editing technology CRISPR, which allows scientists to make very precise genetic changes in cells. These cells were then used to create pig clones so that the pigs would have identical and consistent genetic changes. Their kidneys were then transplanted first into primates and finally into Slayman. All told, the pig kidneys contained 69 genetic changes. The scientists knocked out or eliminated three pig genes that trigger immediate rejection by the human immune system, adding seven human genes to make the pig's tissue appear more human to the immune cells, and inactivated viral genes in the pig cells that could cause infection. They also used a unique cocktail of antibody treatments to further dampen the immune reaction to the transplanted kidney. The company is working on other pig organs as well. In January, eGenesis partnered with researchers at the University of Pennsylvania to transplant a genetically modified pig liver into a brain-dead patient. That work, along with Slayman's experience, is making a strong case for the role of pig organs in addressing the shortage of organs for patients on waiting lists. More than 100,000 people are placed on the kidney transplant waiting list in the United States every year. Only 20,000 kidneys are available. More transplants may provide a better idea of how long the pig kidneys function and whether they can meaningfully extend the length and quality of patients' lives. "For now," says Williams, patients might benefit from receiving a pig kidney temporarily as they wait for a human one, such as bridging can be critical for patients like Slayman. While on dialysis, he experienced clotting issues and required dozens of surgeries to improve his circulation. We never anticipated dialysis would become a lifelong solution for kidney failure, says Dr. Leonardo Riella, medical director of kidney transplantation at Mass General Brigham and lead investigator of the trial. Yet, this is the stark reality for over 600,000 patients in the United States. Dialysis has sadly become their last resort for managing their disease. Now, picture a different narrative, one where healthy kidneys are readily available for transplantation. Today, we're offering a glimmer of hope that may one day be possible for many more patients. Next, we have, from the space part of the brief, how nature reacts to a total eclipse, and this is by Jeffrey Kluger. Of all the animals worth observing during a total solar eclipse, perhaps none are more intriguing than humans. They stop what they're doing. They stare upward. They stare skyward. They lower their voices to a hush. Some may even shed tears. Other species of animals display other kinds of behavioral changes as the weather and lightning and nature itself seem to turn on their axis. And the total eclipse on April 8th, which crosses the United States from the southern western edge of Texas to the northern tip of New England, is no exception. Some of the greatest changes during a total eclipse occur far above us, in the ionosphere, the band of atmosphere that ranges from an altitude of 37 to 190 miles. Defined by the abundance of electricity-charged particles, or ions, the ionosphere is denser during the day, turbocharged by incoming radiation from the sun. That means during an eclipse, the overall concentration of ions in the ionosphere falls. This reduction can lead to a cooling of the upper atmosphere, which in turn can cause local depletions known as the ionospheric holes. Those cavities may disrupt radio signals and lead to anomalies in GPS navigation systems. But according to researchers, in most cases, the disruption is transitory and too mild to notice. Other natural changes are more universally detectable, not least the dimming of sunlight. The closer to the arch of totality, the deeper the darkness experienced. Temperatures can drop by anywhere from 5 degrees Fahrenheit to 15 degrees Fahrenheit as the sunlight retreats. Falling temperatures may also cause what is known as an eclipse wind, or the slowing of the winds. That's a result of low-level air becoming cooler than higher-level air, which makes it harder for the more elevated atmosphere to mix with the air that's closer to the ground, eliminating the temperature and the density differences that leads to breezes and gusts. As the totality ends, the winds pick back up. Another effect falling temperatures may have is the appearance of fleeting thunderstorms, as cooler air closer to the ground pushes warmer, more humid air upward, where moisture then condenses and rains out. All of this affects non-human animals in multiple ways. Insects, bats, birds that feed at night emerge as the sky darkens. Birdsong tends to grow quieter as the darkness descends. The crows, the gulls, the sparrows that are in flight have been observed aligning on trees or on the ground and silencing any chirps, calls, or caws. Dogs may cower or exhibit other fearful behavior. Bees may return to the hive, and domestic horses and cows may move to their stables. Perhaps more striking, though, was the behavior of a captive troop of chimpanzees at the Yerkes Primate Research Center on the campus of Emory University in Georgia during an annular eclipse on May 30, 1984. As the researchers observed, the animals moved to the highest point of a climbing structure in their enclosure and turned their faces upward towards the sun and the moon. The chimps remained that way until the skies began to brighten when they descended from the structure. No one can ever say with certainty how they were experiencing what they were seeing, whether they felt their own form of curiosity or wonder. Clearly, though, they were captivated by it all. It's a reaction that is very much a piece of what humans feel, one we may share with untold numbers of other species as the Great Solar Sky Show unfolds. Now we have health. How to respond to an insult according to therapists, and this is by Angela Haupt. Have you ever been stunned into silence by an insult, only to think of the perfect witty comeback 2 hours later? Of course you have, and there's a physiological reason why. When someone says something offensive or harmful that hurts us or hurts a member of a community that's really important to us, our nervous system can get activated, says Kerry McBroom, a psychologist in Brooklyn. The parts of the brain that are responsible for coming up with clever or witty things to say are just not online. They're nervous and sensing a threat. That's why planning ahead is essential. There's something really life-affirming about having something to say ready to go in your back pocket, says McBroom. Pulling off a sharp response can boost your confidence and be such a source of pride. We ask therapists to share their favorite comebacks that either invite additional dialogue or shut down a conversation. The first one is, hey, flag on the play. When Ajita Robinson, a therapist in Bethesda, Maryland, is taken aback or confused by someone's words, she pulls out a sports term, hey, flag on the play. By flagging what someone just said, Robinson is making it clear that their words were out of bounds or requires further classification. Folks usually respond pretty well, like, what are you noticing? She says. One of Robinson's clients, for example, recently went on a date with a man she thought was too sexually aggressive. The woman said, hey, flag on the play, and he understood that he had just crossed the line. It's lighthearted, she says, but sends a signal that the comment or the interaction crossed the boundary. Next we have, could you repeat that? I don't think I heard you correctly. This line is particularly effective when you're in a group of people or when someone mumbles something under their breath, says Amanda Stemmen, a Los Angeles-based therapist who teaches mindful communication skills. A lot of times when people say something rude, it's impulsive. By asking them to repeat themselves, even if you had no trouble hearing them, you're extending an opportunity to rethink or rephrase what they just said. Often they'll realize that a bunch of people are around and they don't want to say it louder because there's a shame going to kick in. Stemmen says that it de-escalates the situation. Next we have, what a wild thing to say out loud. McBroom's favorite comeback is useful when someone says something prejudiced or outright bigoted. She smiles and brightly responds, wow, what a wild thing to say out loud. They rarely see it coming, she says. By throwing them off their rhythm or startling them, they're able to question something that they previously had not questioned. She's found that often people will realize they should examine their bias and reflect on why something they thought was acceptable to say did not go over very well. Next we have, you should come with a warning label. Your cousin keeps bringing up politics at a kid's birthday party. A friend's sense of humor makes the group feel uncomfortable. Aunt Gladys has decided it's a good time to dispense some diet tips. To handle these unwanted conversations, Katie Gillis, a psychotherapist in Lansing, Michigan, sometimes opts for a lighthearted response. You should come with a warning label. It makes people laugh, she's found, diffusing a potentially tense situation while letting them know that they're crossing into an inappropriate territory. Most people successfully get the message that they should change their tone. And lastly, number five here, I don't get it. Can you explain that joke? Perhaps you're eager to shut down the conversation, especially around an inappropriate joke. Asking the person to explain what's so funny is a terrific way to hold them accountable for their behavior, says Kristen Suleiman, a therapist in Houston. They might think twice next time. She recommends delivering your question with genuine interest while trying to maintain compassion. The goal is not to humiliate the other person or to appear holier than thou, says Suleiman, is to create curiosity about the purpose of their comment. And I think we have time for one more. The 5-minute quiz that helped catch Olivia Munn's cancer, and this is by Alice Park. Actor Olivia Munn recently shared in an Instagram post that a free risk assessment tool her doctor used revealed that she had a higher chance of developing breast cancer. It led to testing and eventually treatment that likely spared her from a more serious outcome. The breast cancer risk assessment tool is not new. It's been around since 1989 for women between the ages of 35 to 74 and doesn't even require a doctor. The online questionnaire available through the National Cancer Institute, the NCI, asks about a woman's age, her family history of breast cancer, when she began menstruating, and how old she was when she had her first child, and if she had any breast biopsies. It then estimates her risk of getting breast cancer in 5 years and over the course of her life. This calculator is a great first step that women can do on their own and discuss the results with their primary care doctor or gynecologist, says Dr. Jennifer Litton, professor of breast medical oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center. The tool was built using data from the Breast Cancer Demonstration Project, a 1970 study of 280,000 white women, and the NCI Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Results Program, which is data from Black, Hispanic, and Asian women, which were added later to provide more accurate predictions for women of different races and ethnicities. While still less accurate for women of color, research has found that the tool is about 98% accurate in predicting disease risk. It's especially helpful for those who have a family history of breast cancer, people who don't know their genetic risk for the disease, and those who don't have major genes for breast cancer, such as the BRCA1 or the BRCA2, which was the case for Moon. About 500,000 women use it annually, according to the NCI, and after Olivia's post, the Breast Cancer Risk Assessment Tool received a dramatic increase in visits, according to a spokesperson. Some doctors use the questionnaire in conjunction with a slightly more comprehensive one called the Tyrer-Suzuk model, which is also free and available online. Together with regular mammograms starting at around age 40, these risk assessments will help the doctors decide which women should get mammograms more frequently and whether they need additional tests like an MRI. Knowing a woman's risk score can lead to early detection of cancer as it did for Moon. Yet many women aren't aware that there's a short risk quiz they can take, then discuss this with their doctors. Knowledge is power, says Dr. Larry Norton, medical director of the Evelyn H. Lauder Breast Center at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. The more you know about yourself and the more you engage with medical professionals, the better you can get answers that are appropriate for you. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from Time Magazine. We were continuing with the April 8th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.